Good evening and welcome to the Professional Learning for Teachers channel on Radio Edutalk. My name is David Noble. I'm, as ever, in Dalgety Bay in Fife, and delighted to welcome to the show this evening Claire Bryden, who is a charter teacher and teacher of English at Oban High School. Good evening, Claire. How are you?
Evening, David. I'm very well, thank you. Delighted to be here.
Oh, fantastic. And just going to be hearing about your charter teacher journey, some of the fantastic practice that you're involved in within your school and maybe previous schools. So really just a kind of overview of your work, your recent work as a teacher. And if anybody has a question or a comment for Claire, you can get in touch in two ways. If you're listening to the live show, you can email edutalker, that's edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk. Or if you use Twitter, you can just fire something up on there using the hashtag Edutalk. So, Claire, just to start off with, could you give us a bit of a kind of background to your career in education?
Well, I qualified as a teacher in 1998. I always knew I was going to be a teacher. And I did my degree at Edinburgh in English Literature, and then I did my PGCE, as was, at Murray House. So qualified in 1998, and then moved down to the Borders. And I spent about a year and a half in Selkirk High School down there. And then in 2000, I moved to Earlston High School, also down in the Borders. And I was kind of always constantly looking for ways to kind of push myself and challenge myself. And in 2003, so 10 years ago now, I accepted a year's placement in Japan. And I travelled to Japan, and I worked in Japan as a language assistant in a senior high school in Japan. I was there for a year, as I said. And when I came back, I knew I was coming back to kind of settle permanently in Scotland. And I really wanted to continue kind of pushing myself in the classroom. And the Chartered Teacher Scheme seemed absolutely perfect. So I went there, decided to go down the Chartered Teacher route. And I did it through the Accredited Prior Learning route. And I qualified as a Chartered Teacher in 2008. And worked as a Chartered Teacher in the Borders for a couple of years. And then in 2010... my husband and I decided that the islands and the mountains of the west coast of Scotland were calling, and I moved to Oban, where I'm still currently working as an English teacher at Oban High School.
Okay, that's fantastic. And just maybe sticking with your charter teacher experience, and you've been chartered now for a few years, and what's it like to be a chartered teacher? Maybe if you want to refer to within the context of your current post or previously, but how has being a chartered teacher influenced your professional life?
It's had a massive influence, I think. The whole journey towards being a chartered teacher is obviously something that I think is extremely valuable, not least because of the focus that it places on the importance of professional reflection. And I think once you get that idea of professional reflection and you start looking at yourself and you start looking at practice constantly and evaluating where you are and trying to improve on it, and I think that's always going to be an ongoing process. So it kind of completely changed my whole attitude to teaching and gave me a massive motivation. It also, of course, makes you extremely aware that there's still more that can always be done and can be developed and can be changed. But I suppose on a practical level, getting the Chartered Teacher kind of accreditation, having that kind of external objective verification of my job and what I've been doing, I think has been a big confidence booster for me as well. And it's let me know that I'm kind of on the right track and I'm engaging in professional dialogue in a kind of consistent and valuable way. I think it's had an impact as well in terms of confidence, in terms of the fact that I'm not afraid to put myself forward for things. I think I'm more confident in contributing to discussions, to exploring ideas, making suggestions within the school environment that I've been in. I am also more comfortable with the idea of being challenged, you know, because you have to challenge yourself in terms of your own personal journey. So I'm more able to kind of have my ideas tested and explore them. And I also, it's interesting, I also kind of feel as if I trust the people around me more in terms of like the teachers around me, that I trust their professionalism as well, because I've engaged with so many other teachers' professional dialogue as part of my own journey. And you realise, I mean, obviously, it should be obvious, but you realise that so many teachers, well, most teachers, not all teachers, are genuinely reflective practitioners, and they're very skilled in working with people's needs. And when you can come together with those practitioners, then that can be a tremendously valuable thing. I suppose in terms of like classroom, the impact on my classroom experience, I've definitely become more systematic in looking at the way in which I do things, using formative assessment techniques, trying to evaluate where I am, trying to engage in that process of evaluating and then kind of developing my practice and then evaluating again and moving forward in a kind of constant cycle of reflection. But what I found really interesting has been the experience of changing schools. Because I did all my work and development for my chartered teacher claim in the Borders. So I was kind of part of that community and I knew a lot of people within education there. I was becoming a familiar face and lots of people went through that chartered teacher journey with me. You know, they kind of contributed to my final claim. And then moving to a new area of the country and starting a new school. And it's an interesting, strange experience going to a new school as a chartered teacher because you have a certain kind of momentum. And a certain expectation, I suppose, that people will kind of realize that you're used to standing up in front of groups or leading learning. And, of course, being a chartered teacher is kind of an invisible thing sometimes. There's nothing there to tell people that you are one, you know. There's no letters after your name on the staff list. You're not wearing a badge that says, I am a chartered teacher. But then I've always taken being a chartered teacher very seriously. I do feel as if, you know, I have to earn my money. I feel as if we have a professional responsibility as chartered teachers and we have a collective responsibility for making our schools better. Schools won't improve unless teachers take kind of collective responsibility for that. But moving schools, you can't kind of go charging in and trying to be at the center of change instantly in the way that I maybe was in my previous post, because it takes a while to work out how a school ticks and to work out what a school's strengths are. And not just cling to the idea that just because things were done a certain way in your old school, that's the way they have to be done in the new school. So I had to find my feet very carefully as a chartered teacher. And that was an interesting experience because I had to not be too pushy. And I sometimes got the balance right and sometimes I didn't. But I do, it's been amazing moving schools as a chartered teacher because I do feel valued as a member of our school community. It's been really interesting to continue my work in a different context. And I do feel as if I've been given lots of opportunities to grow and develop. I've kind of carved a role for myself now as a chartered teacher in my new school. I chair the learning and teaching group, and I'm trying to play a role as a facilitator for more professional reflection amongst all of the staff and bring that kind of element of the chartered experience to play, chartered teacher experience to play. And being part of that learning and teaching group gives me the opportunity to remember that enhanced practice is kind of something that all staff should be involved in, but also because of the new changes that are taking place in the new curriculum, I'm very much aware that enhanced practice applies to the individual classroom as much as having a role within the whole school itself. So I've been heavily involved in the development of new courses for the new curriculum as well within my new school as well. So yeah, I keep calling it my new school. I've been there 4 years now and I feel very, very settled.
Yeah.
But that experience of changing school has been a very, very interesting one and very interesting as part of my kind of whole journey as a chartered teacher, I would say.
And, I mean, I've had the benefit of, in the past week, having a look over your commentary and reflective report, which might not mean much to people who didn't go through the chartered teacher experience, but moving away from the formalities of the chartered teacher programme and more kind of delving deeper into your actual practice, what was it, what aspects of your practice did you write about, did you exemplify, you know, back five, six years ago, and, you know, to what extent was that influenced by, for example, your travels and your time in Japan?
Well, the areas that I looked at were, as you know, like accredited prior learning, you kind of put in three areas that you're looking at. And the three areas that I developed as part of my chartered teacher claim were developing my teaching of higher English, specifically trying to help pupils become more metacognitive, asking them to look at the way that they were learning, and also trying to develop a variety of approaches to the ways in which I created learning experiences in the classroom, accessing different learning styles, to try to kind of enrich their whole learning experience, to try to move away from the idea that once pupils get to 16, we spend lots of time early on in the school environment giving pupils lots of exciting experiences and lots of interesting things and setting up all these experiences. And then they get to 16 sometimes. I felt, anyway, what I was doing was they get to 16 or they get to their kind of the higher courses or their intermediate two courses, and suddenly I'm expecting them to sit still, be quiet, take in this, pass the exams. And there was a mismatch there, and I was very, very conscious of it. So I tried to work out how to kind of develop that sense of kind of interactivity, I suppose, in my older kind of students. So I explored that. The second thing I looked at was I looked at extracurricular activities. I have always been, since I first started teaching, very involved in debating. And I've also, not so much in Oban, but certainly when I was down in the borders, I was very involved in taking kids away on residential trips as well. And the two things seem quite different, but when I looked at them, and again, I'll come to Japan in a second, but that kind of had an influence on that. When I looked at them, in the two of them, the idea of kind of challenge and challenging pupils seemed to be at the heart of both of those. So I looked at developing that idea of challenge, and I looked at kind of the importance of that in kind of day-to-day life in schools. And then the third aspect that I looked at was the idea of basically building learning communities. And I looked at that in terms of trying to build up a sense of discussion and collegiality amongst my department. I looked at links with the primary schools, so trying to build up a learning community amongst the high school and our cluster primary schools, and then finally looking at the region as a whole and the borders and becoming involved in that that broader learning community as well. And each of those things does continue to be a focus in kind of my day-to-day life of being a teacher. But in terms of Japan was an amazing experience. And I was there, so it was 10 years ago since I went. So it did have a massive influence on me, and it helped me, I suppose it helped me in two major ways. It helped me to reevaluate the relationships that I developed with students, and it really kind of honed my focus on this idea of challenging students as well. Japan's a really, it was an interesting experience. I was a language assistant in a high academic senior high school in Kumamoto Ken, which is in Kyushu in the south of Japan. And I didn't know any Japanese before I went there, so I was put into the situation of being a learner again, which was very strange and obviously gives you massive respect for pupils who are being in that situation every day. But the education system that I was in, and I think it might have been, education is kind of changing and developing in Japan as anywhere else, and obviously this was only a kind of very limited experience, but in my experience of it, education was very geared towards a specific role in Japan. You went to the school that reflected your exam results up to that point. It was quite difficult to step outside of that predetermined role. And I was in a high academic school, and so education was approached in a very kind of traditionalist, behaviorist way, I suppose. It was very chalk and talk. And I suppose I kind of came from that kind of background myself in terms of my education. It was pretty traditional schooling. Listen to history lectures, repeat them back in essay format. So I suppose in my early years of teaching, that kind of background of teaching probably had a wee influence in the way I approached teaching as well. But in Japan, to really draw pupils out, because of the language barrier, because it was a very traditional situation, I really had to engage with them on a personal level. I had to try and draw them out individually. And it made me really appreciate the ease of communication that I had with the pupils back in Scotland, and made me realize how much I kind of undervalued it, that sometimes I kind of treated them like a homogenous class instead of really encouraging that two-way communication and encouraging pupils to feel comfortable within the classroom. So one of the massive impacts it had on my practice was when I came back, it made me realize the importance of creating really good relationships with pupils and creating a safe space for them where they feel valued and included and as if you're actually genuinely engaging in dialogue with them. So that became higher in my list of priorities. But the major thing, I think, was the challenge thing. And schooling might have been very traditional in the classroom, but they were challenged on so many levels outside of the classroom. They had these immense, amazing school sports days in the school where I worked, where they did these fantastically choreographed displays, which were intricately planned and must have taken hours and hours and hours and endless rehearsing. And everything was the responsibility of the pupils. They took on every single aspect, the planning, the organization, the rehearsals, and every extracurricular club in the school was run by the pupils. And they had a random member of staff assigned to them who might not have had anything to do with that particular skill, because, and it didn't matter because it was the pupils who ran everything. I also worked one day a month in a special needs school while I was there. And I don't have very much experience at all of working with special needs in a special needs environment, but I was very impressed about in terms of how much the pupils there as well could learn beyond what might be considered kind of the usual expectations. And it made me kind of really appreciate how much sometimes we have a fear of letting kids take responsibility, and we have a fear of challenging pupils. And that idea of challenge is really important. And that sometimes we underestimate kids, and they never cease to amaze us when they're actually given the chance to take on leadership roles or asked to take kind of on challenging activities, and how many of them really rise to the occasion. So, yeah, I think in terms of building my relationship with pupils and developing that idea of challenge, which became a key focus in terms of my reflective report, both of those things, Japan had a huge influence on them.
Yeah, and I mean, it sounds as if that had such an impact in your whole philosophy about teaching and learning. Can you trace that those experiences and those kind of changes to your mindset right through to aspects of your current practice? I mean, I'm thinking even just again reading about some of your work, just how you seem to extol the benefits of travelling to young people, and indeed give them plenty of opportunities to travel rather widely and experience other cultures.
Yeah, well, while I was kind of doing all my charter teacher preparation, I read a really interesting book, which was Colin Mortlock, and it's called The Adventure Alternative. And it was published in 1984, so it's quite an old book now. But he talks a lot about the importance of adventure in young people. And I've got it written down. I think he says it develops skills of determination, self-confidence, patience, self-analysis, self-reliance, and the ability to follow and to lead efficiently. And he talks about the dangers of underestimating the capabilities of the young generation. And it's interesting because travel has been something that I've been involved in with children, and taking them away on residential excursions and looking at the kind of facing up to the emotional and the physical challenges of being away from home, often for the first time. And you could see the tremendous development that took place in their personal and social skills. And I was also, which isn't in my reflective report, I also spent several years being heavily involved in a group called the Borders Exploration Group, where we took young people, 16 to 25-year-olds, away to culturally and physical challenging environments. And we took part in community and environmental work in adventure phases and went hiking and whitewater rafting and things. And exactly the same thing came there. You saw just how much pupils rise to that challenge. And I do think that, I mean, travel is one way of challenging yourself, certainly. And it doesn't have to be travel to kind of exotic, far-off places either, particularly now living in a community where lots of students come from quite small communities. That opportunity to put themselves into new situations just by, it doesn't have to be abroad, just going to a different area of the country or going to live in a city for a while. But that chance to put yourself in a new situation, circumstance, and see how you cope, it's part of kind of growing into a well-rounded individual, isn't it? And it fits in with, you know, every single one of Curriculum for Excellence's priorities. And then, so that's travel, but that challenge doesn't have to be a travel thing. As part of, like, as I said, I've kind of been involved in debating, and I have been with children to various kind of debating and parliament situations with them, where pupils have been consulted. Like European Youth Parliament things and all the rest of it. And pupils' opinions have been sought, but with the best one in the world, sometimes I've been struck by how pupils' views are kind of accepted uncritically sometimes, that people ask some questions and they genuinely want to hear what the pupils have to say, but once they've got the pupils' response, that's kind of accepted. Whereas I think sometimes we, like I said before, we underestimate our young people. They kind of deserve to be challenged in their ideas. If they can have a real sense of value in what they're saying and a real sense of really thinking their ideas through properly, then they deserve to be challenged, to have their ideas questioned within a supportive environment so that they can kind of grow and they can learn and they can change. So, yeah, challenge was absolutely central to my chartered teacher claim. And it started off from thinking about the challenges that come with travelling. But, yeah, it grew into a sense that this idea of challenge and this idea of kind of giving people a safe environment where they can explore their ideas and be challenged is really important to them.
I'm just wondering, Claire, that everything you're saying makes so much sense, and you're talking about how it links in with so many aspects of the curriculum. I'm wondering how you go about kind of selling the benefits or just selling the opportunities for travel to young people, maybe particularly those who may appear to be fairly comfortable in their current surroundings.
I think it's, how do you do that? I think it's partly, isn't it, to do with the relationships that you build up with the students, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think, you know, when you're in a classroom situation, this is the same for anybody, you know, as you develop relationships with pupils and they come to see you as a person as well as a teacher, so sharing ideas and sharing stories. And I'm tremendously lucky in the sense because I'm an English teacher and I get to read novels and stories with the kids, you know? And so, I mean, that's a tremendous kind of way in, and that's a tremendous way of kind of encouraging these ideas. But I think increasingly in schools, don't we? We kind of talk about, I mean, certainly in Oban, we talk about the world around them. We talk about charities. We talk about people in other cultures. One of the things that we do in Oban, and I know a lot of schools across the country do it, is that we now have a kind of an extended tutor time in the morning. So we have half an hour with the kids every morning where we're looking at things like citizenship. We're looking at being part of a global community. We're looking at other cultures. And we're talking about the kids' futures, what it is that they want to do. And you can discuss these things. And I think there's always a danger in saying to kids, you know, you must go traveling, you must do this, you must do that, because every pupil, every child obviously has to do what's right for them. But I think opening up those opportunities and making them aware of the fact that there is a broader world out there, and they are, and giving them the confidence to be able to go and explore it, you know, which is what the new curriculum's all about, isn't it? This idea that they're going to be confident individuals, and responsible citizens. The more confidence that they have in themselves and the more we can build on those skills in school, the more likely they are to be able to think of themselves in other contexts and to be able to go out there and grab those opportunities. It's about being a lifelong learner, isn't it, really? Having the confidence to step away from school and be equipped with the skills that they need to go off and explore the world for themselves in whatever way that is, whether exploring the world is going to the other side of the world or whether exploring the world is just kind of expanding their horizons a wee bit. But however they do it, I think that's what the skills that we need to equip them with in schools, isn't it?
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Claire. And moving on now to, you've taken us through the fact that you have an extensive commitment and involvement with CPD, or professional learning, as some people might refer to it now. So what does that commitment look like in 2014?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, like anyone else in Scotland who's working full time in the classroom just now, you know, CPD can be a struggle. But I mean, like I said at the start, you know, this idea of being a chartered teacher and placing professional reflection at the centre of everything, it really needs to be, doesn't it? And I know, like, I'm not saying anything new here. It needs to be at the heart of our role as educators. And it's so important for us to have time and space to look at what we're doing and to share ideas and to learn from each other. For me at the moment, in my particular context, I said that I'm working with the learning and teaching group at Oban. And it's been quite an interesting journey, actually, looking at CPD, because initially I set up a group to focus on sharing good practice in the school. And what we did was we organized sessions for staff. So we'd have ideas for things that we thought that staff should know about. So it might be things like starters and plenaries, or it might be things like aspects of AIFL, formative assessment. And what we would do is we'd set up a meeting, and then staff would come along, and then we'd have volunteers to stand up and say, look, this is what I do in the classroom, and then everyone would go away. And it was essentially kind of chalk and talk for teachers. And then after a while, we kind of reevaluated it and went, well, this isn't necessarily really doing anything that fits in with our general philosophy with what we should be doing in the classroom. So we kind of then developed into a group where we offered a kind of an informal drop-in session for staff, allowing them to come along and discuss kind of any professional aspect. We realized the importance of creating staff space for staff in the really kind of busy environment that we're in at the moment. It could have been a space for professional reading. I publish every month. A colleague of mine puts together a Sharing Good Practice newsletter where he kind of collates aspects of sharing good practice, aspects of educational research, aspects or examples of things that people have done well. We put them together into a newsletter. So we had a space where people could come along and could kind of read that. But I have to say that, you know, it wasn't because of the lack of structure to it. It wasn't particularly successful. So we had to find a balance somehow between this kind of come along and we'll tell you what you're doing, or come along and we'll have this kind of hazy idea of what we'll do in space. So what we're trying to do now is we're trying very much to create a space for in-house CPD that's slightly more structured within the school. So we're working with staff to work out what direction it should go in. We've done an audit of CPD needs with our staff, what they need. We're trying to take on aspects that staff themselves have identified. And then so far we've set up opportunities for Prezi, online video editing for training in that, a session on encouraging reluctant learners. And the great thing about it is because it's kind of come from the staff, and because it's not being led by the senior leader team, it's come from within us, it gives members of staff the opportunity to take on kind of leadership roles as part of the group. So therefore it's kind of giving them a valuable CPD opportunity, as well as creating a kind of wider CPD opportunity within the school. But what we're kind of focusing now on is providing a space for staff to self-evaluate really against the relevant professional standard, and encouraging, I suppose what we really want to be doing is encouraging staff to kind of move beyond the standard for registration and towards the standard for career-long professional learning. But just giving staff that space, I think. CPD, so often we think that CPD is kind of going on courses, particularly at the moment, relating to the new qualifications, it's going and doing that. But we're really trying to create a space at the moment to just sit and reflect with other people and talk about what we've done and get that kind of genuine one-to-one, well, not one-to-one, but that genuine kind of feedback from other staff and that kind of sense of support within the school. And what's another interesting thing is I've noticed just from my own experience, and I'm sure loads of other people have realized this as well, have seen this as well, but in the light of the kind of the stresses and the strains that are on teachers at the moment, there's a lot of new stuff coming in, people are very busy, you know, class sizes are increasing. The idea that CPD can focus on kind of personal well-being as well, I think, is quite an important one just now. We've sessions on, for example, mindfulness, of being mindful, coming up at the moment. And we've had also recently had a health and well-being session, which is encouraging us to take time out to appreciate each other. And this awareness that where we are personally has a massive impact on how we cope professionally. So moving away from the idea of CPD, I suppose, as, yeah, courses and bits of paper and stuff like this, and looking at CPD, which comes from the ground upwards, it's developed by teachers for teachers, and CPD, which focuses on our kind of our personal development as well as just looking at acquiring bits of paper and going on courses, that kind of idea. It's kind of where I personally feel I am in terms of CPD and where I feel as if we are kind of as a school.
I mean, that's absolutely fascinating to hear that particular take on an aspect of CPD within your school. I'm just wondering then how, I would imagine that if it was top-down CPD, so to speak, then there would be the risk that sessions and mindfulness and such like, and, you know, keeping a check on yourself, you might be seen as superficial. So any kind of insight or ideas as to how you make sure that this focus on the well-being of staff is actually embedded and actually does make a difference?
I'm not sure. Well, I haven't been on the mindfulness courses yet. Maybe when I've been on them, I'll have a better answer for that. I think it's got to be rooted in the ethos of the school, hasn't it?
I think
it's that sense of rootedness, isn't it? It's a sense of where things come from. I mean, you know, when things kind of are handed down from on high and somebody says, look, this is what you should be doing, and then it's kind of like a ticky box exercise, I think that's when things become superficial, don't they? If something's coming from a groundswell of opinion from within the school, and it's being led by teachers themselves, and I think this is where the chartered teacher thing comes in again, it's this belief that, you know, we have, is it Andy Hargreaves in What's Worth Fighting For in Your School? And he talks about the fact that unless professionals take responsibility for change within the school, then change is never going to happen. So it has to come from teachers themselves. It has to come from the needs that teachers themselves identify. And it has to grow from that. It almost has to be an organic process. And that way, you can try to make sure that it is something that is seen as having value, and it's something that becomes embedded within the ethos. Whereas, I've always been kind of slightly wary of this top-down approach where things are handed to you and you're told, this is what you should be doing. We've got this great idea. What do you think about doing this? Let's do this. I think you have to look at it from a different perspective, don't you? So rather than top-down, it has to come from the ground up and then become embedded. And I think that's kind of how you need to approach it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't necessarily want to labour the point too much or put you excessively kind of on the spot, Claire. I'm just wondering how... I just think it's such a great kind of collection of ideas there for CPD. I think, the unfortunate thing would be is if you're then trying to kind of measure some kind of outcome that, you know, mindfulness training and such like will lead to, you know, so many fewer exclusions for young people, or such and such a percentage reduction in staff absence. It sounds to me as if it's such a great idea that it should really just be done really well, and hopefully it'll have an impact, and it's maybe not one that we have to measure or track through a school improvement plan. As I say, really interesting. Now we're just coming to the last 5 minutes or so. I'm hopefully going to attract a couple of questions from our live listeners this evening. I know that there's at least a few out there. Again, from kind of getting an idea through your writing of aspects of your work, you've got experience of mentoring. So can you just say how that's worked for you, and how someone new to, maybe even a requirement to mentor within their professional roles, how might they begin to approach such a role in their school?
Well, I've had kind of mixed experiences mentoring. I think it's obviously an extremely valuable thing because it ties in with everything I've been saying about teachers learning from each other, being part of a community, developing this idea of collegiality. I suppose going right back to the very beginning of my teaching career, the very first year of teaching, I was only working 0.8. So the deputy at the time asked me to evaluate the school's mentoring scheme, which they'd recently set up, which was geared around underachieving pupils. So it's a mentoring scheme for pupils, underachieving pupils in S4. And one of the interesting things that I found out as a result of it was that one of the main issues was a gap in expectation amongst staff in terms of what the mentoring scheme was about. Lots of staff thought it was about raising the self-esteem of the pupils, and lots of staff thought it was about raising their academic progress. Now, obviously, the two are not mutually exclusive. You know, if you raise self-esteem, that you would hope it would have an impact on academic progress. But yeah, one of the kind of things that came out from that, I suppose, was that if you're approaching mentoring, you need to kind of have a clear idea from the outset as to what it is that you're kind of looking to get out of the mentoring process. What is it that actually your end kind of expectations are? In terms of my own experience of being a mentor, I have in the past mentored, as lots and lots and lots of people have, obviously, probationer teachers and also kind of student teachers within our school. And really, the most valuable CPD that I kind of went on a CP on the course before it, and it was a course which kind of structured the idea of mentoring around three questions. And it said, if you focus your mentoring around these three questions, then this kind of provides a basis for a kind of a way forward. And the three questions are, I suppose, where are you now is the first one, and then where would you like to be? And then the third one is, well, what do you therefore have to do to bridge that gap? And what I found really interesting from that was the way in which it the focus falls on the kind of mentee, as it were. I use this system a lot. I use it with classes at school. I use it with classes after prelims. So after they've done the prelims, I ask them to go through this process. And it hands the responsibility over to the person who's kind of looking to move forward, doesn't it? But I think that's the hardest thing. I find it personally, the hardest thing about mentoring is not to just say to people, well, this is the way that I would do it. This is the way I would do it. This works for me. And it's remembering the fact that everybody isn't the same and that people need to be able to find their own solutions to things. And I suppose it comes back to not being a control freak and trusting people to find their own direction, and trusting people to actually know, really be able to kind of self-examine and know what direction they need to take. And it's a challenge, and it comes back to that idea of challenge again, doesn't it? It is a challenge. It's something that people, you know, in the mentoring situation, that idea of providing people with that challenge to work out for themselves where they need to go and the best way to go to get there is really important. I have very much enjoyed any mentoring that I've ever done. But it is something that I have to, it's something that I still need to work on, because I still have that instinct within myself to try to say, look, this is the way I think you should do it. And realizing that actually it's a far more complex thing than that. That you have to be handing responsibility to people and trusting people, I think is kind of central to my ideas of like of what's at the heart of the whole process.
In terms of giving opportunities for pupils to rise to an occasion and to take kind of leadership roles, I mean, another aspect of your work that seems to have run through several years of your practice is the debating. So just to finish up, Claire, you know, again, you know, how does that work in practice? How do you attract people to these opportunities, which I think have also involved travel and performing, so to speak, at very kind of high level events? And again, what kind of long term benefits to have you seen and the pupils that have participated?
I just think debating is a fabulous thing for kids to get involved in. And I think the danger with it is it's sometimes seen as quite an elitist thing. And I've tried very hard to get it away from that idea. And obviously there is an element of it which kind of is reliant on high academic ability and so on. But I think there's a space in debating for kids of every single ability across the whole of the school. Obviously, as an English teacher, I love debating because I think we have a responsibility to equip pupils with the best communication tools to which they've got access. My favourite quote of all time is Wittgenstein, and he says, the limits of my language are the limits of my world. And this idea that we should, it keeps coming back to challenge, doesn't it, but we should be encouraging pupils to explore the world through the use of language is a tremendous thing. it comes back. I've already mentioned the way in which I've been involved with kind of youth parliament consultations and things like this, and the idea that pupils aren't kind of genuinely challenged. But this idea that we underestimate them, I'm amazed when I see how well kids can cope in debating situations. We recently had an independence debate in Oban. We had Mike Russell was on the panel, Alan Reid, various other councillors and panel members, and we had two pupils from the high school on the panel as well. Excuse me, fifth year pupils. And they acquitted themselves admirably. They were articulate, they were full of conviction, and they were just giving pupils that opportunity to be on that kind of forum is a fantastic thing. And I think as well, the other thing about it is that, you know, I think sometimes one of the great things about debating is that in education, sometimes we kind of focus on the need to be right all the time, don't we? And like we kind of treat mistakes or saying the wrong thing as errors, things that should be kind of hidden away. And I think it gives pupils the confidence to stand up and to say something and then to be challenged and maybe sometimes to be wrong. But it gives us the opportunity to introduce that idea of coping when they're challenged by other people, which I think is really important. And the other thing it does is it counteracts this idea that kids should just parrot back what the teacher's telling them, and it places value on their own point of view. And the other thing I love about it is that it enables you as a teacher to become a learner alongside the pupil, because you get an idea or a topic that you decide you're going to explore and you're going to look at the sides of, and you're kind of in the same position as them because you're not picking something you're an expert in. You can pick a random thing. A kid can pick something out of the air. It doesn't matter who comes up with it. And you become a learner alongside them. So you demonstrate the traits of, I suppose, somebody who doesn't have answers, who has to work stuff out, who has to structure ideas, who has to restructure them or rethink them. And then if you're doing that alongside pupils, then the pupils begin to demonstrate those kind of characteristics themselves. And, of course, it's also such a, I mean, I suppose you can have debates on anything. You can have debates on whether Santa is better than the Easter Bunny, which we've had, and whether the Tooth Fairy is real, and the Harry Potter versus Twilight, which we've had as well. But, I mean, essentially, you know, you are most of the time dealing with real life, you know, like proper problems. And again, if we come back to this idea of trying to encourage pupils to be responsible citizens, effective contributors, you know, it ticks all the boxes, doesn't it? Successful learners, confident individuals. I find quite often, to get away from that idea of it being elitist, the idea that you don't have to single people out either, that pupils can work as teams. They don't even have to work within the formalized structures of proper formal debates. It can just be part of the development of kind of questioning, making pupils defend themselves and encouraging their trust in their own thought processes. And then, of course, it can lead to tremendous successes. And when pupils do succeed on a kind of a larger scale, on a national scale, or even within the school, if they do, like we have an inter-clan debate, the clans are like our houses in Oban, at the high school, and giving pupils that platform, it's tremendously empowering for them. And yeah, it's something that I've always been involved in, and it's something that I will continue to be involved in all the time.
Great stuff, Claire. Now, we're just, as I say, coming towards the end of tonight's show, and if you are listening to the podcast and you've got any follow-up questions or comments for Claire, then two ways to get in touch. You can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk or pop something on Twitter with the hashtag edutalk. Now, I think a colleague or friend of yours, Claire, Barbara van der Meulen, has been in touch over Twitter, and she's just saying that it's great stuff from you tonight. She agrees that school improvement and professional development don't come from anywhere other than from teachers themselves, certainly not from bits of paper. Uh-huh. But she does have a question for you. It's going back to mentoring, in this case, of early teachers. Uh-huh. And Barbara asks, what is the most important factor to have in the culture of the school to do the mentoring of early teachers well?
In the school itself?
Yes.
What's the most important factor within the school itself? I think when you're an early teacher, I'm thinking back to my own experiences. It's such a scary thing, teaching, isn't it? You know, when you first start, and you're kind of, you're not, I mean, obviously you have lots of support, but having, I think sometimes having not a subject, especially having a culture within a school of discussion, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. Because I think sometimes being able to speak to other members of staff who are not necessarily your a subject specialist, but who are but have experience across the whole school can be massively valuable. So an ethos within a school that encourages staff to share their ideas and to share their mistakes and to share their kind of things that they would do better next time. A school which encourages that and which isn't suggesting to people that they have to be, they always have to present their best side. Do you know what I mean? A place where teachers feel safe. I think I've mentioned the idea that that it's important for pupils to feel safe within a classroom. And if pupils feel safe, then they get the confidence to grow and to develop. And I think it's the same for teachers. I think an ethos of a school has to be such that you know that it's okay to go to someone and say, look, I'm having problems with this. Look, I'm having difficulties with this. And that you know that you're not going to be met with judgment or with somebody saying, well, this is how you should do it. But you're just going to be met with the space to be able to kind of work it through and for people to be able to share their own experiences and their own learning experiences as well. So it's part of that kind of ethos of acceptance and support within a school. It's very important.
It's a great place to finish, Claire, and I have to say it's been absolutely amazing to have the opportunity to put some questions to you this evening, and I think your responses and your comments have been inspiring. So thank you so much, and I really do hope that that many people around Scottish education, maybe further afield, get the chance to listen to the audio from the show.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Okay, and best wishes for the future.
Thank you very much. And so to you, David. Pleasure to speak to you.
Thanks very much.